Oh, we will not be finished with Ecclesiastes today. I think the lectureship and my voice will be ending about the same time. I'm delighted to have been here, and you all have persevered to the very end, and you've meant so much to me. It's just been a pleasure. As Solomon would say, it's been a delight, it's been something to seize, to be here with you. I said yesterday that I wanted to pick up some stitches that I didn't get in, and I left one thing because I didn't want to press through it. When we're talking about wise counsel, I suppose one of the most challenging sections of Ecclesiastes, and there are several. I just passed by those, you know. I observed the Passover on some of them. But I had in mind to give you the broad picture of Ecclesiastes, and then you can continue your study as I'm continuing mine of this great book. But the seventh chapter, verses 16 through 18, says something rather startling. Don't be overmuch righteous. Neither make yourself overwise, for why should you destroy yourself? Don't be overmuch wicked, neither be foolish. Why should you die before your time? You know, if we take this at face value, it'd be a very cynical kind of statement. How in the world, we ask ourselves, could you ever be too righteous? And what is the sense of saying, don't be too wicked? In view of the whole context of Ecclesiastes, I just cannot imagine that Solomon is saying something cynical. There has got to be some quotation marks around that word righteous here. And it's my impression that what he must be saying is that there are some forms of righteousness that are just too much. And we might ask ourselves what that could be. Well, one is self-righteousness. That's too much. This great overweening sense of confidence in our own goodness. In this very context, and a few verses later, he says, surely there is not a righteous man upon the earth that does good and does not sin. And when we conclude that we are the exception to that rule, that we have not been guilty of any wrongdoing, that's being overmuch righteous. And when it has divided the spirit of the Pharisee in Jesus' story of the Pharisee and the publican, when he's thanking God that he's not like other men, extortioners and adulterers, etc., even this publican, that is overmuch righteous, to say the least. The other possibility, it seems to me, is a little less venal, and that is that righteousness that Job assumed thoughtlessly when he decided that he could stand in judgment on God. And he began to criticize in his anguish. And we need to remember that, as he told his friends, it's easy enough for you, you're in perfect health, you're not suffering like I'm suffering, and I know you can find a lot wrong with my words. But he said, I'm in misery. But he, when he proposed to say to God, this is not right, he was saying, you have done wrong. And if you're going to judge God, you've got to get on a higher platform than he's on, and that's a little difficult. Since he is the eternal, the creator of all things. And we have to be careful of that temptation that Job succumbed to. At least those are some suggestions of how someone might become over-righteous. I suspect that when he says, why should you destroy yourself, he may have more earthy consequences in mind than eternal ones, but I can't be sure of that. But there are consequences for that kind of superciliousness, I'll tell you. You destroy relationships with others. You're ineffective as far as trying to be of real help to other people spiritually. And I may say that preachers who get that kind of spirit in them really do great harm to their effectiveness. I think people need to realize, as we preach to them, that we are where they are, that we're struggling as they are struggling, that we're battling as they are battling. And as a brother, and as someone who's sitting in the same circumstance as they, we're simply trying to encourage and to strengthen them, rather than to pose as someone who has it all together, and it's too bad about the rest of you, but I'll see if I can throw you a life preserver somehow, and get you out. The second statement, don't be overmuch wicked, maybe that's a little more challenging. Why would you be wicked at all? I can't imagine that Solomon would counsel someone to be wicked in any sense. The whole context of the book says otherwise. In what sense then does he speak when he said, do not be overmuch wicked? I've thought of some possibilities. I take you to Romans chapter 6 verse 2, where Paul says, shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? And I think that's pushing the envelope. I think when you just decide that grace is abundant, I might as well make use of it. Plenty of forgiveness out there, and so we'll just go on knowing we're living under grace and not be concerned about all these picayune kind of infractions that we might be involved in. The Apostle Paul evidently was accused of preaching that kind of message. That grace is so great that we don't need to be concerned about sin anymore. And Paul just said it plainly. Because grace is so great, we are very concerned about sin. And we don't want to be a part of it anymore. And perhaps also in Romans, the second chapter, where Paul is warning some people about pressing too far with their bold sinning, and maybe losing something very critical. In chapter 2 and verse 3, and do you think this, O man, who judges them that practice such things, and you do the same, that you shall escape the judgment of God? Or do you despise the riches of his goodness and forbearance and long-suffering, not knowing that the goodness of God leads you to repentance? Don't be foolish and push this thing so far that even the goodness of God no longer is able to draw you back. That is real folly. And we may say more about that from the latter part of the book. There's one other thing, too, that I wanted to quickly discuss. One of the featured things in Ecclesiastes is the idea that justice is just not done here. And people who do well and live righteously have awful circumstances in which to live, and sometimes people who do the most wicked things have the most physical blessings in life. And this statement is made in chapter 8, verse 11, and may be applicable to justice as it's done in this world among men, and it might have reference to justice as God meets it out. Because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily. Therefore, the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Let me just say this. The question arises, why does God let all this happen? Why doesn't God just get down here and give some immediate recompense for wickedness and immediate reward for righteousness? Well, I suspect he could do that. I mean, anytime you sinned, you might get a headache that absolutely make you want to die. I mean, if that happened every time, you'd probably be induced to stay away from that. But why? And at what depth would you be committed to righteousness? And if you did what was right, and if God gave you a pleasant high, and suddenly money began to arrive in your mailbox, and everybody you knew that was ill got well again, what do you suppose you might do in such instances? It's sort of like putting a rat in a maze and inducing him by pleasure and pain to certain forms of behavior. You'd be a case of classical conditioning. But how deep would it go? There's something that I want to read from the Screwtape Letters here. I don't want to bore you too much with this. I think I've cited it once. C.S. Lewis's strange little book. And now we have Screwtape talking to Wormwood, his nephew, and these are both demons, and he's giving him advice. You must have often wondered why the enemy, that is God, does not make more use of his power to be sensibly present to human souls in any degree he chooses at any moment. But you now see that the irresistible and indisputable are the two weapons which the very nature of his scheme forbids him to use, merely to override a human will, as he felt, as his felt presence in any but the faintest and most mitigated degree would certainly do, would be for him useless. He cannot ravish. He can only woo. He leaves the creature to stand up on its own legs, to carry out from the will alone duties which have lost all relish. It is during such trough periods, he's been talking about people feeling God is far away in their spiritual life. Have you ever felt that, when it just seems as though God is far away and the joy has gone out of serving him? And Lewis makes the observation that that's a part. I believe it's a part of every spiritual life. I think that that's experienced. But he says it's during these trough periods, Screwtape says, much more than during the peak periods, that is when God is, you feel him very present, you're exhilarated at the thought of it, that it is growing into the sort of creature he wants it to be. He wants them to learn to walk and must therefore take away his hand. And if only the will to walk is really there, he is pleased even with their stumbles. Do not be deceived, Wormwood. Our cause is never more in danger than when a human, no longer desiring but still intending to do our enemy's will, looks round upon a universe from which every trace of him seems to have vanished, and asks why he has been forsaken, and still obeys. Remember Gethsemane. So maybe that'll help. If you feel forsaken and God far, far away, then just remember he is not. That's only an emotional impression. And when you look around and the world seems to be crashing in, just remember that all things will work together for good. And you do right even when you don't feel like doing right. It is in those times that the character of Christ grows deeply within you. And I think that was a valid point made by Lewis. Now let's take up the last part of the book. I want to begin with verse 7 of the 11th chapter, which I think should be paragraphed. It is not in the American Standard Version. The New American Standard paragraphs at this very verse and takes it to the end of the chapter. Truly the light is sweet, and a pleasant thing it is for the eyes to behold the sun. That's a really touching kind of verse, and it strikes a note with me. I can remember as a young lad coming out and just feeling the sun on my face, and of course I got a few more freckles in those days because I was so fair, but it was just a delight on a summer's day, the sunlight shining. And I've had that experience of, in some measure here in California, just to get up and the sparkle of the day is marvelous, and just the thought of being alive. And what he's saying is that it is a sweet thing to live in spite of everything else. There is much that's an evidence of God's goodness and mercy, and it's a pleasant thing for the eyes to behold the sun. Yes, if a man live many years, let him rejoice in them all. That's a theme of the book too, isn't it? Rejoice. Eat your food with gladness. Spend your days with your wife with delight, and your children, and let every day be pleasant. We know it's uncertain. Solomon says it's uncertain. You don't know what may happen any moment. But take each day as it comes to you, and savor it, and enjoy it, and appreciate it as the what? The gift of God. And I think if we cherish these things as God's gifts, because even in this world of vanity, the presence of God's goodness is reflected. I know that it's not a straightforward picture with all these catastrophes and disease and death, and yet the evidence of his love, I think, is here. He's not left himself without witness. So Solomon's advice is, use these days and treasure them. But let him remember the days of darkness, for they shall be many. I have no any other interpretation of that than that which is brought to our attention. The 12th chapter of days of darkness, the days of declining years and death. And that has to be kept in mind. That's the reason Solomon said it is better, and I'll get it right this time, it's better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting, because the living will, that's the end of all men, the living will lay it to heart. And that sorrow is better than laughter. That doesn't mean it's wrong to laugh. It just means that you learn lessons from sorrow that cannot be learned some other way. And we need that to learn those lessons. But you be sober while you're being joyful. The combination of sobriety and joy is the counsel of the preacher, and I think a very valid one. He said, all that comes is vanity. That is to say, what's going to come is not going to be pleasant. It's not going to have about it all the advantages of your young days. And you need to keep that in mind. And now he comes to young people. I just have the feeling, and I'm so grateful for the young people who've come to these morning sessions. They've been a delight. I try to hang around them thinking it'll help me out and maybe draw me back from my aging experience, but they're just a delight to be around. And he takes young people seriously, and we need to too. Of course they're young and inexperienced. We were too at that time. We thought we knew more than we did. I think it's just part of the process you know more than you've ever known before. And you don't have any conception at that point of how much more there is to know. And sometimes we laugh at young people when they have heartache from their first puppy love that is shattered, and we say, oh, don't pay attention to that, you get over that. Well, so much for you, you've been through it. But so far as they're concerned, it's the only thing they've ever known. And so it's just as well that we don't get so cavalier about that. We want not to fall into a state of convulsions over the matter so that they think the end of the world is about to come, but at the same time to treat it as from their vantage point. But Solomon takes young people seriously. And I think he intends for them to take themselves seriously. Indeed. He says in verse 9, rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth, and walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes. But know that for all these things God will bring you into judgment. Now, he's talked about judgment before. This is not his first excursion into that issue. In fact, it came very early in the book, actually. Chapter 3, verse 17. I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time there for every purpose and every work. God will judge. And always we have to keep in mind that Solomon, if he doesn't have the conception that we see and the revelation that we see in the New Testament of the glories of heaven, it's not in the book of Ecclesiastes. It's just not there. And there's something else that it seems to me is missing there, and that is this urgent concern to do good for others and to fill your life full of those things. Though it's intimated in many ways, it's not a strong feature of the book. He has his point to make, and I think he makes it well, but it takes the gospel to fill this thing out. He is not aware of that. He has not seen the beauty that Jesus has brought to us. And by the way, we ought to think about that. We are truly blessed to live in this time and to see these things so richly played out as they have been in God's eternal scheme of redemption. But he says to the young man, rejoice in your youth. I don't believe he's being cynical there. I don't think he's saying it like this. Well, go ahead. Live it up. And do all that stuff you want to do. But you better remember this. The Lord is going to bring you into judgment about it. I think he means very earnestly. Behave joyfully in your youth and enjoy your youth. Now, you know what we do. We say to young people, we said, you know, act your age. We don't mean for them to act their age. We mean them to act our age. We don't want them enjoying it. I don't know whether we're being sort of jealous and we don't want to see anybody else having any fun. Some people think Solomon had lost all his youth and didn't have a very good time of it. Now he's going to try to take everybody else's good time away. And that's not it. He's truly saying that you ought to enjoy your youth. I remember my youth. I remember the exhilarating feelings of my young boyhood when you just get out into a field and run for the sheer delight of it. I mean, it was just delightful. Now, it would kill me. I have the feeling every now and then, and the impulse, but it doesn't last long, you know. And so, when you're young, taste it and drink it down as a gift of God. As a gift of God. He has given you this time, and it's an important time in life. And you ought not to act like you're 50 years old, but to rejoice in what God has given you. But always this sober reminder. Remember that God will judge you for these things. Don't use your youth foolishly and stupidly, doing things that are going to bring you into disaster ultimately. Therefore, he said, remove sorrow from your heart and put away evil from your flesh, for youth and the dawn of life of vanity. What does he mean by that? How does he at one word say you ought to really enjoy it, and then again he says it's all vanity? Well, I think it's that same problem we've been working with through Ecclesiastes. If you're thinking of youth as what life is all about, if you think that's what you've got to have to be happy, and the loss of it is going to be utter disaster, if you're building your life on some sort of youthful syndrome, I will tell you that it's going to be miserable at last, because youth is not forever. But at the same time, while it's here, be joyful in it and thank God for it. This has been a youth-conscious nation. I don't know. We went through that Pepsi generation thing, and then we got the beer commercials that we got to get all the gusto we can get. But there was a fear in this country of aging. And those who were aging were trying their dead-level best to disguise it by acting like they were 25. Not possible. Is there such a thing as growing old gracefully? I suspect we ought to grow old gracefully, and we ought to grow old thankfully. Thankfully. I wouldn't mind going back physically to my earlier days, but I would hate to know as little as I knew in those days. And sometimes I imagine that I knew more then than I really knew. I rewrite history a bit, and sometimes that was true during my child-rearing days. I forgot that when I was their age, I didn't know much either. And I had to learn patience, remembering my own follies. But at the same time, you can't cosmetize it out of existence. You're getting older. People tell me that I haven't changed a bit. I said, I've been looking old a long time. Well, it is. Kind of an advantage after a while. But the point is that youth only lasts a short time, and if you think that's what life's going to be about, all that exhilarating activity, and you've got to be able to go here and do that, it's not going to last. And you have to be sober and wise enough to recognize that fact and live your life with that truth before you. And when it happens to you, don't get full of despair. There are people who will not let you know how old they are. They're not going to let it be known. I'm not being harshly critical of that. But I'm just saying to you, I'm grateful for every year God has given me. Why should it trouble me? As someone says, why are people who believe in eternal life so sensitive about age? And then somebody else said, never had so many lied so much about so little. As age, it's sad that that's the case. So, youth cannot be made your God. And you cannot keep worshiping at the fountain of youth as you get older. Accept the growing years. Accept the responsibilities and the opportunities that they give you. It's amazing to me. As a young preacher, I said many of the same things I'm saying now, but for some reason, people listen to them more than I have become older. Maybe things have happened that I'm not aware of. But we get some credit as older people that we did not get as younger people, and I think it's because others realize we have been down the road a piece and we have learned some things. And maybe we are wiser in the way we say it, and humbler too. Because when I was young, I remember having spoken on a lectureship at Abilene. It was the only time they ever let senior students speak on a lectureship. I guess we ended that after we had done what we did. But after I had spoken very rigorously about how the churches needed to wake up and how we were becoming hothouse Christians, spared any kind of real challenge. And I met one of my professors afterward expecting him to say something rather complimentary of what I had said. Essentially what he told me, he said, you've got a lot to learn. Let not the man who's buckling on the armor speak as the man who's taking it off. And he saw in me what was present. I didn't like it at the time, but later on I realized what I'd done and felt rather ashamed of myself. I had no business saying some of those things. I didn't have the credit to do it. They might have been true, but I was not the man to say them. But at any rate, the last chapter here says to young people, remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, when you shall say, I have no pleasure in them. I believe that what comes afterward may well be an allegory of declining health and death. Some think it's actually a description of a funeral taking place. It's difficult always to get it, and I won't go into the details of it, but there seems to be, at least to some minds and to mine as well, that there is a parallel between some of the things that are stated here and what happens to you when your body and your mind decline. And he's right in this. You need to remember your Creator in the days of your youth, and young people need to hear that because of the decisions you're going to make in your youth. Critical decisions, like who you're going to marry. That is a significant thing. And even more critical, the issue of in your early days, taking upon yourself the responsibility to serve God. Because in those early days, you can't just say, King's X, I'm going to just sort of kick up my heels and run around, and it's not going to have any consequence. I'll tell you this much, you've come to the time in your life when what you do has consequence, and it doesn't make any difference how much your mother and father love you, they cannot take it away. And you have to think about that. These are sobering years, too. And you have to realize that habits you develop now, over time, will develop deep crevices in your character, and it will not be easy to crawl out of those deep crevices and change the direction of your life later. This is a significant time. And for that reason, the remembering God is so important at this time. Because the evil days will come. I think all of us imagine that we'll have those pleasant hours when we can kind of clean up the mess and tell God we're sorry for all those bad things we did, and then just turn around and begin to do the good things. It will not be that easy. In the declining years, pain can get so oppressive that the mind doesn't work as clearly as once it did. And if you think resolve is easy in those days, I think you'll be mistaken. If you think radical changes will be easy in those days, I think you'll be mistaken. I think it'll be the time in your life when they will be most challenging of all. Young people can make the changes more easily. Older people have a greater challenge because they have developed long-standing habits that are going to be escaped with great difficulty. How well I know it. So, remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of decrepitude and inactivity, because you are no longer able, come. And then as he said poetically, verse 6, before the silver cord is loosed, or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher is broken at the fountain, and the wheel broken at the cistern, and the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. When those things you did, and those activities that were a part of you, are no longer possible anymore, and you go to your long home. So we have to be sober before that realization. And for the young people, Solomon said, rejoice in your youth, remove sorrow from your life, and remember your Creator. But then he sums it up in the epilogue, as he speaks about the preacher was wise, and he taught the people knowledge, pondered and sought out and set in order many proverbs. Find, he said, he sought to find acceptable words that were written uprightly, words of truth, ultimate truth, I think. The words of the wise are as goads, and that's the reason we take them up. And as nails well fastened, they are security, they are solidity, they are a sure foundation, given from one shepherd that I take to be God. And furthermore, my son, be admonished of making many books, there is no end. And much study is awareness of the flesh, which is to say, human wisdom leads nowhere. The books will come, the books will go. You will never learn who you are, why you're here, and what your task is in the meantime. This is the end of the matter. This is Solomon's conclusion, but it is not something he surprises us with at the end. It's not something that comes out of nowhere. It's been in the book all along. This is the end of the matter. All has been heard. Fear God, reverence God, and keep His commandments, for this is the whole of man. That is what we are for. And if we're going to find happiness, it will be because we didn't seek happiness, but we sought God, and we revered and reverenced Him from youth to old age, enjoying His gifts, grateful to Him because of those gifts, but even in that enjoyment, we are focused upon God and what He is doing to bless us. And our task to fear God and keep His commandments. Somebody said it sounds like legalism to me. Keep His commandments. No, this man is speaking as one who's already said there's not a righteous man upon the earth that does good and does not sin. He also says that God made man upright, verse 29, chapter 7, and they've sought out many inventions. He said all that. He's saying here about the will and the direction of our lives, the earnest desire of our hearts. We have set our hearts upon this, that what we're going to do, even if nothing else gets done, we are going to reverence God and we are going to keep His commandments. It's our life. And I want to stress that. When Paul says in Colossians 3 that Christ is all, that's the way it is. An old friend of mine buried in eastern Kentucky has this recorded on his gravestone. Christ is all. And He is that. There isn't anything else. And Christ must overarch everything in us. And God must be the center of everything and the circumference. And if we can get anything across as we preach, it's to get people to realize that this is not just a hobby. That this is not just an important hobby. And that this is not just some really important part of life. It is life. It is life. And so we thrust ourselves into it with the whole of our being, because God will bring every work into judgment with every hidden thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. And I admit to you freely that Solomon's treatment of this thing does not have the joy about it that you find in the New Testament. And I'm so glad that God has burst upon the scene of history in such brightness of joy and goodness as He has in Jesus Christ. And Solomon knew a lot of things, and he said them, and they're true, guided by the Holy Spirit. But there was more to come after Solomon wrote. Now, he learned a lot of things the hard way. And he's saying to us, don't make the mistakes I made. Don't waste your life. Don't make stupid blunders as I made them. But serve God all your life and keep His commandments, and it'll be a blessing to you. Thank you.